Assalamu alaikum and welcome to Remember Palestine with me, Lauren Booth. There are just days now until the UN is forced to make a decision on Palestinian statehood. The region is vibrating with anticipation, hopes and, for some, fears of the repercussions of the Palestinians finally having a legally recognised state. One group preparing a bloody response to Palestinian statehood are 500,000 illegal Jewish settlers in the West Bank. I'll be talking to a member of the International Solidarity Campaign about Palestinian hopes and anxieties as the big day approaches. But first, let's go to this report from our West Bank correspondent.
Just 3 weeks from now, PA Chief Mahmoud Abbas is expected to address the United Nations and deliver the highly anticipated request of admitting Palestine as a full member state in the UN. The move has received mixed reviews from Palestinians. Some has welcomed it while others are casting doubt on its usefulness.
We've been expecting this move for a long time. We hope that Palestine will be recognized by other nations.
The Israelis who oppose this step maybe do the difficulties, more difficulties in the Palestinian territories.
But one question remains, the one that is Palestinian par excellence, the right of return, this 64-year-old and most persistent questions of all.
Of course, all Palestinians would love a Palestinian state on which they can live in dignity and freely. But the problem with the UN initiative is that it does not consider the one of the most main points and issues of the Palestinian people, which is the right of return.
Official circles, however, see the move as means to an end and promise to restore Palestine, or at least recover what the international community allotted.
Going to the UN is not the Palestinian strategy. Going to the UN is part of the Palestinian strategy. Palestinian strategy is to restore Palestine to the geographic map. And to the geographic map, Palestine is coming. On 67 lines, with East Jerusalem as capital.
Even among the PA, there's now an undertone, a veiled warning of what may come next.
I would tell Mr. Netanyahu, read carefully the articles of the Hague Conventions of 1907 and the Fourth Geneva Conventions of 1949, specifically on the responsibilities of occupying powers. This authority was born to transfer Palestinians from occupation to independence. There is no other task for this authority.
There's widespread speculation now on whether the move will help in forming a united international front against the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories, or will it merely open the way for more talks between the two sides? Without a doubt, this PA initiative has generated a lot of discussion, and the right of return is not the only one. For immediately less obvious but no less significant is the level and extent of Palestinian recognition of Israel. Will this recognition, unwillingly or otherwise, extend to what Israel has perceived in itself, primarily Jewish? Reporting for Remember Palestine, Ibrahim Husseini, East Jerusalem, Al-Quds.
Well, as we heard there, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu posed a challenge to the Palestinian Authority, asking if it would recognise Israel as a Jewish state. The response of PA Prime Minister Dr. Salem Fayyad was that Israel's character is its own business. It's not up to the Palestinians to define it. Well, I'm joined via Skype now by Dr. Hussein Ibish, a senior fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine, to discuss this and other aspects of the UN's coming decision on Palestinian statehood. Thank you very much, Doctor, for joining us today.
It's a pleasure, thank you.
Let's begin with the veto from the US, which seems to be the main obstacle for the Palestinian bid for statehood.
It's the main obstacle to Palestinian bid for full UN membership, because the way the process works is a putative state applies to the Secretary General, who refers that application to the Security Council. The Security Council has to recommend it to the General Assembly, which then needs to adopt it by a two-thirds vote. The United States has made it clear it would veto that. So the possibility for full UN membership for the Palestinians is out of the question at the moment. The alternative that people are discussing, one of many alternatives, is to bypass the Security Council altogether and forego full UN membership and not even force the question, but go directly to the General Assembly and ask for a change of status from having a PLO mission, which is a political entity observer, to having Palestine being a non-member observer state. Now, in the past, there have been 16 non-member observer states, all of which have become UN members eventually, with the exception of the Vatican, which doesn't want to be a member. And that's if you count unified Germany and unified Vietnam. So that's the big appeal to the Palestinians. There's a complication here, though, because although there's no doubt that they can get a majority very easily for that in the General Assembly, the Israelis seem to have put together a group of about 28 or 30 major countries, most of the West and Japan, which would probably vote no on that, so that they could say, well, yes, most of Asia and Africa and Latin America have voted for this Palestinian observer, non-member, quote, state, close quote, but we have what they would present as the so-called civilized world in their camp. Mm-hmm. And it would be a kind of weird victory for Prime Minister Netanyahu. So the Palestinians find themselves in a very awkward situation. And then, of course, there's the question of Israeli and American retaliation. So it's really a very complicated problem.
Okay, so let's skip over the problem for a second. Sure. What would be the benefits of Palestine getting UN recognition as a state?
Well, I mean, they couldn't get membership, so that we needn't bother with, because that's just out. That would be the final stage in the creation of a Palestinian state. That would mean Palestine is an independent state forever, but that's not going to happen this year. The benefits to joining as a non-member observer state would be greater privileges, and what they are hoping for is, among many things, is that if they were a non-member observer state, they could try to accede to the Statute of Rome and join the Assembly of Parties of the ICC, and then start bringing charges against Israel in the International Criminal Court and other such bodies. Now, that is a bit of a long shot, even if they got that membership, because in their application during the Israeli war on Gaza a couple of years ago, the PA in Ramallah did apply to the Statute of Rome, saying, we give you authorization to have jurisdiction over the territories under our control, including Gaza, meaning please prosecute the Israelis for what they're doing in Gaza. That's basically what it meant. The ICC received that, but they didn't make a judgment, because of two things. First, because of the undetermined nature of Palestinian statehood, which I don't think would be resolved by observer state status. And also because of the question of territory, which again would not be resolved. So I'm not sure. I think the advantages would probably be largely symbolic, although it would do this. It would solidify the international consensus that a two-state solution is absolutely the only thing the world will accept, and they will not accept the occupation. And that would be a benefit.
Final answer, if I may. Sure. Obama talks of two states. Then is clearly going to veto any votes towards that solution. How's that playing in America, very briefly?
I mean, this is really a very serious situation for the United States, because they will end up, as they did with the vote against settlement activity in February, voting against their own policies. In this case, it's pretty simple. They want to protect the American brokered process, the bilateral negotiations brokered by the United States. They don't want this process moved into the multilateral forum of the United Nations, where they would have less control. The problem is that, in the end, nobody else wants to be the broker. It's not just that the United States is hoarding the process. It's that there aren't any other candidates. No one's volunteering.
That's very, very true, and a perfect place to end on. Nobody else wants to take that over. Dr. Hussein Ibish in America, thanks very much for that clear roundup. Well, meanwhile, as high politics is played out in Tel Aviv, Geneva and New York, it is, as always, civilians on the ground who will live the consequences of a decision on a Palestinian state. Joining me now in our London studio is international solidarity activist Adi Mormek to discuss the implications from that viewpoint. Thanks very much for coming in today. Reports this week into the very serious rearming of 500,000 Jewish extremist settlers in the West Bank. We hear that the IDF has been handing out stun grenades, tear gas canisters and other munitions. Adi, you've spent time in the West Bank and in Gaza on really the peaceful front line from the Palestinian perspective, trying to press for rights. You've seen the settlement movements at first hand. How real is the threat of a backlash against Palestinian civilians by them, would you say?
Well, it's huge, but again, the threat is real at every moment. That right this minute, we can guarantee that settlers are burning up olive groves of Palestinian farmers, or they're attacking Palestinian families, women, whoever, in Hebron, for example, where it's just a mental situation of about a few hundred settlers controlling thousands and thousands of Palestinian villages, it's a large town there. The threat is real because the Israeli government has always supported the settlers, and it's used its state apparatus to endorse whatever they want.
But to actually re-endorse that at this very pivotal moment in a political process, what's that doing to people you know in the West Bank? What's the feeling there?
Well, the feeling is that things are going to get harsh, but the people are ready for it. The people are spirited because they're used to this, and this is just another sort of extra attempt by Israel to try and punish Palestinians. But they know that the movement around the world and the movements against the settlers internationally are changing now. There are much bigger links made from outside. There are also still continuing international support coming in, and there are many, many groups that are still continuing their demonstrations against the war, against the settlement takeovers there.
Now, at the moment, it's demonstrations against the war, but if this kind of partial recognition of an idea of a state, as we've heard, very factionalised there, comes about, won't the Palestinians have some sort of feeling that they have a right to drive the settlers out?
There may be a feeling like that. What will happen, no doubt, is that we're seeing this enormously violent response that in preparation for Palestinians. It's absolutely disgusting that they're giving them tear gas and other methods to stop them. But ultimately, the biggest sort of help they give the settlers is the soldiers turn around when they start battering women or battering people over their head or setting fire to people's houses in these houses. They've been doing that for years. This is the most violent of support. This has been a continuous policy to expand a greater Israel. They might have a feeling that they can start to oppose Israel more if there was anything passed through, but ultimately there are fears and there are risks about pushing forward for this two-state solution in the General Assembly. There is many risks because, for example, the PA, which is pushing this forward, they only are representing West Bank and Gaza and Palestinians, and they're actually the Mahmoud Abbas's tenure has expired 2 years ago in terms of his electoral mandate. And there's a risk, as put forward by Guy Goodwin-Gill, who was an international law professor from Oxford University, that actually this will overtake and surpass the representative body, the PLO, Palestinian Legislative, the Palestinian Liberation Organization.
And the importance of that, of course, is representing the diaspora of many millions of Palestinians externally, East Jerusalem, and the status of the Palestinians within what's called Israel.
Well, this is the huge risk. I mean, if you look at Oslo, for example, in 1993, everybody, there was what Dr. Haider Aid in Gaza called an induced euphoria, where the media jumped on an agreement, or a settlement, and nobody saw coming the fact that in 1993 there was 193,000 settlers, nowadays is 500,000 settlers, 500,000. How are we seriously going to think that Netanyahu is going to pull out 500,000 settlers from the West Bank? Is he serious that they're going to sacrifice the 87% of the water aquifers are serving the citizens, or the arable land that they've stolen? Are they really going to give all that back? Are we serious about what would be any kind of justice for Palestinians? And this is the major risks in terms of the right of return. That's a huge issue. Most of the Palestinians are outside of the West Bank and Gaza. People must be represented.
Thanks very much. That's all we've got time for, and we'll have to wait and see what the actual situation is in the coming weeks. Thanks very much. This week, the BBC's flagship classical music event, the Proms, welcomed the Israeli Philharmonic Orchestra. But pro-Palestinian activists calling for a cultural boycott of the Zionist state held a protest. Joining me down the line now is the organiser of that protest, Naomi Wimborne Idrisi. Naomi, welcome to RP.
Nice to be with you.
Please tell us about the event. 40 people, pro-Palestinian protesters, arrived at the Royal Albert Hall. What took place?
Right, okay. Well, organised with a lot of planning in advance by Jews for Boycotting Israeli Goods, Brick Up, that's the British Committee for the Universities of Palestine, and people in the Boycott Israel Network. People arrived prepared for heightened security, because although the Proms organisers said that the decision to invite the Israeli Philharmonic Orchestra is purely musical, it was clearly a political decision. They sent out letters to ticket holders telling them that bags would be searched, no flags would be allowed in. They were obviously quite aware of what they'd done. So we expected it to be harder than it actually turned out to be. We all had tickets in different parts of the hall in a number of small groups. There was about 9 or 10 groups altogether, one of them very large, and this large group made the first intervention. What we did was we had prepared in advance a song adapting the tune of Beethoven's very famous Ode to Joy, and what we sang was, Israel, end your occupation, and we went on from there with some words which people can find online on some of the reports. And we sang this in a quiet moment in the first piece while unveiling a slogan, reading Free Palestine. So in some of the reports you'll read, there's a lot of confusion about this, but this is what actually happened. And we kept on singing our four lines of text over and over again while the audience reacted. People snatched the letters of the slogan out of our hands. People started to push us. And gradually the Royal Albert Hall security staff made their way over to us. They did their job. They weren't aggressive. They said, come on, you've made your point, please go. And, you know, gradually, because of the pushing and the shoving and the angry response of the audience, some of the audience, we made our way out, but we went out still singing, and we went out and joined the public protest outside and continued singing there as well. So that was the first intervention. Then after that, that piece was finished and the next piece began. This is a rather beautiful violin concerto, and we decided that...
Naomi, I'm just going to cut you off there, because what I'd like to know just before we finish, because we're running out of time, is what do you think you succeeded in actually doing? What was this boycott intended to do?
Right, okay. What we were intending to do was give Palestinians a voice. The reason that the Palestinian Boycott National Committee and PACB, the Campaign for Academic and Cultural Boycott, have called for is a South African apartheid-style campaign of boycott, because nobody listens to the Palestinians. Nobody listens to the victims in this struggle. Israel has the ear of Western governments, newspaper editors, you name it.
Naomi Wimborne Idrisi, thank you very much for that. And people can look up your protest on YouTube. So as with cricket, now with classical music. Thank you very much. Well, A.D. Mormek of the ISM is still with me in the studio. We were talking before we heard about that protest, about the announcement coming up in the UN. What will happen after the vote? As an activist with the International Solidarity Movement, once say people see Palestine actually appearing on maps next to Israel, what will happen to this movement to boycott? What will happen to this growing incentive to act against Zionism?
Well, obviously the fear is that at the moment, if they present something that is a dilute sort of Bantustanized state. Remember that Netanyahu's suggestion for a Palestinian state was chicken pieces. That is like a finer solution, which is like the South African Bantustans. Indeed, Archbishop Desmond Tutu has called it worse than apartheid, and this is why there is a fear that, for example, the movements for example, right of return, which is a vital criteria demanded by the Palestinian organisations demanding the boycott in 2005, which is the right of return under Article United Nations 194. Now, this is a fundamental right. You know, you ask us, hey, a Gazan, where they're from, and they'll tell you Barbara, they'll tell you Hebron, they'll tell you Bergerje, or places that were destroyed by Israel when they were ethnically cleansed in 1948. So the boycotts will have to continue, and they shouldn't be, for example, after Oslo, which was actually a signal for Israel to build lots of settlements and everyone to sit there watching, there was the support sort of went down. I think that the momentum is growing and growing now. There's so many boycotts campaigns now, and it's got the eye on the right of return, and the same with the Palestinians inside Gaza and the West Bank and the diaspora. They're thinking about the right of return, which would mean justice, which would mean every person has the same rights as everybody should expect.
We're completely out of time, but we'll probably rejoin you after the vote next week. Thanks very much for that. It's time now for this week's RP Roundup of the growing global resistance to Zionism.
Women from the Center for Palestinian Cultures, located in Jordan, joined efforts this year to prepare the sweets for the Eid festival, which celebrates the conclusion of the month of Ramadan.
One of the most popular things during Eid is this sweet, which is especially made for the holiday. It is part of our tradition too. When a family in Palestine wants to make sweets, all the women of the family get together to make it, as it requires painstaking effort and a lot of time.
The Center for Palestinian Culture started in 1991 to continue the activities carried out by the Palestinian Women Union in Kuwait. The aim of the organization is to promote and preserve the Palestinian heritage.
As an association, we benefit financially during Eid. 1 week before Eid, we start to prepare the nuts and dates for the sweets so that we can finish them on time.
The center employs Palestinian women to help them raise the standard of living and empower them to contribute to the household income. Residents in the Al-Walaja village in the West Bank rallied to protest for the construction of the annexation wall that would divide their land and jeopardize their agriculture. Local and international activists carried banners reading, "Stop the occupation, stop the apartheid." Israeli soldiers attempted to block the way of the march by using an outdated order.
You're violating my right to vote freely, and on top of that, you're violating rights of people that have nothing to do with it.
The demonstration is the first after the Israeli High Court denied the villagers' petition to reroute the wall. More than 1,800 people in organizations around the world have signed a petition to open the Rafah crossing permanently. The international action aims to support people in Gaza and the ongoing Egyptian people movement. As part of the campaign, the organizers were invited to sign the petition and arrange a delegation to deliver it to a local Egyptian embassy on every Friday until the 30th of September 2011. You can also support the campaign through the Facebook page, Open the Rafah Crossing Permanently and Unconditionally.
That's all we have time for in this week's RP. I leave you now with photos taken by children in Gaza on cameras at Press TV distributed there. Many thanks to Nada Issa for help with this project. Goodbye.